Konnichiwa, and welcome to Pod Stallions number 19. I'm Brian, and with me as always is Jason.
Konbanwa.
What's that mean?
Which I think is good evening. Is that good afternoon or good evening?
You're asking the wrong guy.
Well, I say when I my one trip to Tokyo as a young teen with my brother, we said one of the two of those, we said all day long, and we kept getting quizzical looks. I think we did it completely wrong. We reversed it. So all day we were telling people good evening. And then at night we'd say good morning.
Oh.
And we haven't been allowed back since.
But really?
I digress.
Well, you know what? Actually, that's brilliant. I didn't know you'd been to Tokyo, so you're another person I get to be jealous of. Our episode today is a subject near and dear to both of our hearts, and that is Japanese toys.
Yeah.
And I know – I can't speak for Jason, but I know I look at Japan as basically a land of wonder. I love its children's shows. I love its adult programming. I absolutely love their merchandising. And I go on these kind of jags where I get really obsessed with the stuff. It isn't cheap. And then I kind of back off and don't touch it for a while. I'm currently mid-jag because I discovered an eBay or a Yahoo Auction Japan proxy site on Saturday, and it's the worst thing that ever happened to me. No, it's not that bad. Although I will be doing the next episode from my new bachelor apartment.
Surrounded by all your new Japanese
boxes. Surrounded by unopened Japanese boxes. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think you're hitting it. You're saying it very succinctly and very well. It truly is. The great thing about Japanese toys, not just homegrown stuff or – you know, homegrown licenses. You know, we've talked about this before, I'm sure, especially on the James Bond or the Spy episode. I used to have a huge James Bond toy collection. You know, from the earliest Corgis, you know, on up to, you know, the early 90s kind of. Whenever you'd come across the Japanese stuff, it was just mental. Oh. So like whatever they, you know, it just always seemed to me, and we'll get to this bit about being kids and when we just sort of discovered just what they were capable of when it comes to toys. They would always either go in a completely wacky direction with things sometimes or that extra mile. And I'll give you one quick example that just kind of hits me is, you know, Corgi would do James Bond toy, you know, for years from 64 on, they had the Bond lives. So every time a Bond movie came out, everybody pretty much knew one of the, you know, if nothing else was going to be made toy-wise, Corgi was going to put something together for a vehicle from the new movie.
Yeah, and so we were better for it.
We are. And so, you know, people forget. We talked about this in the Spy episode, but it's not like, you know, Roger Moore right out of the gate, everybody just fell in love with Roger Moore. It really wasn't until Spy Who Loved Me. Spy Who Loved Me was kind of like his Goldfinger, because Goldfinger, I mean, Thunderball actually was, you know, the zenith in the 60s for Bond, but Goldfinger was right there. And Spy Who Loved Me was kind of like that for Roger Moore. So just as iconic as that movie was for him, the vehicle in it was the Lotus Esprit, the white car that was a submersible, went underwater as well. Well, Corgi did this really nice vehicle. You flick a switch in the back, and there's a fin system that pops out the back.
Yeah, I actually asked for that for Christmas one year.
Night. Was that last year?
Yes, it was. And every year since 1977, actually.
And it's got the, you know, when it was just a car, it was a car. And then when it became a submersible, these fins popped out above each tire rim. Then these things popped out the back. Well, the Corgi, the die-cast body, the rims were molded on. So you couldn't choose. They were there above the tires. But the back ones popped out when you flicked this switch. And there was a set of missiles that came on a little spindle. So there were like six or eight of them, and you broke them off the spindle, and you put them in the back of the Lotus, the back windshield. And when you flicked the switch, all four of them or six of them, whatever, would shoot up, you know, back when you could have missiles shoot up out of things.
Yeah.
Well, at the same time, a company called Edai Grip.
Okay. Edai Grip. Let's go into this. They made
coolest die-cast vehicles for whatever license. And for Spy Who Loved Me, for the Lotus, they did – I mean, yes, it had some crazy stickers on it that didn't belong there, like, you know, the 007 logo on the door or whatever.
He has to advertise.
Well, yeah, but the fins popped out, and the wheels rotated inside, and the back fins popped out, and the windshield, you know. I mean, it had, like, eight other things that the Corgi didn't do. Mm-hmm. And that when I think of the Japanese way of sort of making toys, that's kind of what I think of. Like, they take it, and they either put a sticker where it doesn't belong, or they go the extra mile and make it insanely better than whatever.
They put their own spin on things.
Yes, well.
Yeah, the Edai grips. I have three of them. I have the Phoenix from Battle of the Planets.
Nice.
And they come in these really cool boxes too. Like they're like a little aquarium. Yeah. And I've got the Shadow 2 and the Skydiver from UFO.
Nice.
And I'm not much of a dinky car guy. I'm not much of a Hot Wheels guy. I know you're more into that than I am. Those were just like, I gotta own these. And there's a third one of Straker's car. But there is, again, like this weird little, like, oh, well, we just can't make it perfect. Like the Shadow 2, I believe, is pink. Which, of course, it was on the series as well. They drove around in a hot pink vehicle.
It's like it's just about there. And then somebody, you know, it's like when you did your, you know, your research paper as a kid, like you did it just perfectly. And then I would do something on the cover sheet or something to screw it up. Like I would just, you know, my wasn't enough room for the date or something. And I did it wrong. And, you know, just it was almost perfect. That's kind of how
I can't relate because I was the kid that was doing it 5 minutes before the bell rang. And I never learned.
So they did crazy stuff like that, but let's go back. Let's go all the way back, as they say, and let's try to do some what do they call it? Sensory deprivation here, and tell me when you sort of discovered this world of Japanese toys.
I guess I was getting kind of aware of it, and this is not a relationship I think that a lot of people will have with it. I was obviously very in love with the Shogun Warriors and robots and things like that. But my dad also subscribed to a magazine called Hong Kong Enterprises because he was an importer of things. So
just for the articles.
Well, it was all just ads. I have them all in the garage.
Nice.
Yeah, they're huge tombs, you know. And I would just go through these and see all these robots and things. And he would always say to me, "Well, one of these days I'm going to go, you know." This is dating him to the Orient, and I somewhere in my parents' house is all these robot designs because in my 7 or 8 year old head, if my dad brought these to a factory, they would make these toys.
Oh, brilliant!
So
wouldn't it be great if that world was that way?
Except that there would be just hundreds of thousands of disappointed children with these terribly. conceived robot toys, but that was kind of my first
of it. So we're talking late 70s here. We're talking 77 78, and we got to get to this because you would probably have a better perspective on this than I would because you know so much about so many companies and the background on things and so on, like why and how this particular moment sort of started to hit the zeitgeist or whatever where they were Japanese, you know, imports were sort of all the rage and they got repackaged and stuff. My initial memories are parallel. I'm not sure which came first here. One, there was a family next door. There was a single mom with two sons. I don't remember the kid's name. One kid was called Greg, I think. And I remember that they had different dads. And I remember that she worked for Northwest Airlines, which eventually my mother got a job with Northwest Airlines, you know, for like 20 years. And that's, you know, well, we'll get to my Tokyo adventure, but that's how I, you know, got to go to places like that. And so I'm probably, you know, 7, 8 years old, right around this time. And she would take these trips to Japan and she would come back with toys for the younger kid who was about my age. And she would come back with these Japanese toys that were just insane. Like I, you know, I knew they were you couldn't just go to Target and buy these things. These were, you know, from her trip, and they were, I don't remember if they were like transforming or if they were die cast specifically, but you know when you see a Japanese, you know, you don't forget when you see these things for the first time. And I remember being very, very jealous. I'd come over to, you know, look at this, you know, kid's stuff, and it was just, it seemed like just really expensive real estate to me, like really expensive toys. But the other thing that happened, and this may be first, I'm sure we all have those memories of birthdays, great birthday parties or specific gifts, you know, being requested or just surprises or whatever. This is Hall of Fame birthday for me, one of my top three. The gift that my dad gave me, it was in one big box. He gave me two things. One was a Marvel Comics collected edition of The Incredible Hulk. So it's 1978 because the cover sticker says, you know, star of the TV sensation, The Incredible Hulk. And I was, you know, addicted to the show. So this is 1978. The other thing, and I still to this day don't know where he got it, a company called ARC. ARC was the name of the company in Japan. I don't know what the company was that imported such things to the U.S., but ARC made a line. I believe this line was based on Ultraman, I think.
Well, that's something I can touch on a little later, but yeah, what happened was you got established Japanese toys being brought in here, and it was just done because it didn't matter here. Do you know what I mean? Like, we didn't have a television series to back it up, but you weren't allowed by law to have a TV show that backed up.
That's right.
The toy line. So now, but, they were just cool looking characters.
Right. But now, see, this is what's trippy about this. So I get the Hulk book, and then the toy is by ARC, I think this line was based on the Ultraman characters and series, although I've never seen an Ultraman that goes in this line. This is one of my, I still have it. I have every bit of toy that came in with this thing. I have it in its box and the styrofoam.
I actually have an original ad for that company somewhere.
Oh, you got to dig that out. I would kill to see
it. Now I remember it's Baltan Sijian, right?
It's Baltan. I've got the Baltan. So he's got that bird face with the two big claws
And he's got to be the most popular Ultra. Like, he's the Dr. Doom of Ultraman.
He is. This toy, I was so enraptured with this. I mean, I literally played with this thing for years. I mean, not just like a couple of months and I'm done with it. I played with it for years, and it's. We'll put an image up, I hope, of it for the show. And what I'm getting at here is, what's cool about this is, when eventually the whole invasion sort of happened, everything was repackaged, new stickers were put on things, they were called something else that they weren't in Japan, whatever. This thing, the only bit of English on this entire packaging was the import sticker that was stuck on it somewhere. Every bit of this packaging is in Japanese. And he comes in this beautiful window box, styrofoam tray, and he's got all these, he's silver and blue and red and green, and he's got 80% of him is die cast and the rest is plastic, and every bit comes apart. So the legs come off, but they come off at the knee too. And you can put him in all these crazy, you know, positions, but all these attachments come with him too, including a Gatling gun that you can attach to his shoulder that, like every friggin' Japanese toy that came out, everything had to shoot missiles. And this Gatling gun, you put like 10 little yellow missiles in it, and when you turn the Gatling gun, they just, you know, shoot out one by one. I didn't lose a single missile. He's got another little hole in his chest where a missile can shoot out of. And they eventually, as I got older and I discovered more about this line, I eventually got the Mecha Kong, because there's a King Kong.
Yeah, except they in the U.S. they just called it Mech Gorilla.
Mech Gorilla.
Because they didn't want to pay the
yes. And he came in different packaging, his jawline, you know, his jaw moved, and he came with a little missile that was basically a big long missile with wings like an airplane that shot out of his chest.
Yeah.
He had two metal spikes that shot out of his nipples, right where his nipples were, and then an airplane that shot out of his chest. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. But
well, they're beautiful figures. They're based on – all of them are based on Ultraman villains. Their ARC never released an Ultraman US or anything like that.
Confused.
But there's a quote from the designer on Wikipedia here that says that the unique designs were my attempt to create character toys that could be enjoyed even by those unfamiliar with the given film or television series.
Well,
so when they got brought over here, they were just fun toys that looked like robots.
Let me tell you something, Mr. Ark, whatever his name is. You did the trick, because I didn't know what this thing was, where it came from, but he interacted with every other toy that I had, and he was my favorite toy. Now, this is in an age of, you know, Star Wars and all the other stuff that we're into. So right around this time, you know, I know this is a Japanese toy. I know this, you know, you couldn't just find this. I don't know. I still don't know where my dad found this thing, but this is when you start to notice, like, the Shogun Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
The Shogun Warriors were not only big as a toy, it was so – but you probably know this because Mattel – I don't know. Were they called Shogun Warriors in Japan?
No, they were called Jumbo Machinders.
Jumbo Machinders. What a great name for a band.
Yep. I'm sure there's several.
Yes.
And they were – I think they were started by Popey in about 1972.
Popey!
Yeah, and which is a name I type into a search engine every day about five times a day. I'm just kind of obsessed with a few things. they created them in the early 1970s, and they were just basically like, you know, let's make a Mazinga, let's – whatever popular animated series and live action. Here's the thing that really – it sets your head. Like, for me, this was a huge, oh my god, what? Was that they made more characters than, like, the Shogun Warriors, they licensed a few characters, but there was just so many more done in Japan, and they did things like my personal favorite, which is Kamen Rider. They did villains, you know, just this crazy amount of characters.
Well, I had, so did you have, I mean, I got
nothing.
Got the large dragon. I always say dragoon because it was D-R-A-G-U-N, but I think people just call him, you know, dragon. But the large dragoon, which again, it's part of this black hole of toys that I don't know what happened to these things, what my mother did. She doesn't like me talking about it, but she did something. And but I would put him back to sleep in his box every day with all of his gear, and I never lost anything. And I also had, I think I had Great Mazinga, but I also had a couple of the die-cast ships. And this is where they really – I was just fascinated with these things and still am, because I'm still discovering – and I'm not even going to say the one that I'm obsessed with right now for fear that someone else is going to jump on my bandwagon and try to find this thing.
I'm totally holding some things
back. There is one that I've just discovered recently that is all these years later blown my mind that I never knew – existed. But they again, the packaging is redone. It says Shogun Warriors and everything, but everything on the vehicle itself is in Japanese. And it was this wonderful, amazing time. It was right on the cusp of something horrible happening with a kid, you know, in one of those little plastic missiles. But you either got, I mean, I had several of these ships with the initial missiles that came with them, and then the next batch that came out, the box had a sticker on that said the missiles pictured on the box not contained in this thing, and then the missiles inside were these giant things that, you know, barely moved. But also, and I didn't know this at the time, it felt Japanese to me, but at the same time, the Micronauts. I'm getting into Micronauts, and I'm getting some of these things.
Well, that's because they were Japanese,
right? But I didn't know.
I kind of got that vibe because I think the original run of Micronauts that I got as a kid had kanji on them. And you know, I have,
I don't know what that means.
Kanji, the Japanese lettering.
Okay.
Sorry,
Captain Tokyo. I
studied karate, So you pick up all this stuff. So
forgot about that.
Yeah, I still actually, when I'm doing like sit-ups or push-ups, I will count in Japanese, which is pretentious as all hell.
Lost me at sit-up.
Yeah, well, I don't do a lot. I haven't reached. It's like itch, and then I'm done. So
87, 88.
I have a pal by the name of Ray Miller who I get to see every year at Mego Meet, and he is absolutely the historian for Micronauts and how they came here. And I'm going to destroy this, because even though I've heard it from him, I've seen seminars, you know, the way I retain knowledge is strange. But basically, you know, and it's convoluted, but let's go back. There's a company called Takara. Takara, yes, had a line of G.I. Joes called Combat Joe. It was actually Hasbro G.I. Joes.
Yes.
That were more into, again, the Japanese put their own spin on it.
Yes.
Then they created a line of toys that is derivative of Captain Action, which was called Henshin Cyborg.
Yes.
And the original Henshin Cyborg outfits, and correct me if I'm wrong, people, they just slipped onto Combat Joe, and you could change Combat Joe into Ultraman, or you could change him into Ultraman's alter ego. I'm not 100% sure which characters they made, but Steve Jobs. They then created Henshin Cyborg, which was a 12-inch tall. He looks basically like a 12-inch tall Micronaut. And okay, the major difference between Captain Action and Henshin Cyborg is, the Japanese figured out how to market just the plain character much better than Ideal ever did. You know how Ideal threw in all, like, you know, Captain Action's arsenal in his car, but kids, yes, just didn't give a crap about him? Well, they did really groovy things with just the regular Henshin Cyborg. Like, he had interchangeable arms, and he had all this interesting technology. So they were carrying that for years. Denny Fisher in the UK bought the idea from Takara and released the Henshin Cyborgs as 8-inchers in the UK.
Is it Denny Fisher or is it Dennis Fisher? Is it Denny Fisher?
I don't know.
All these years I've always said Dennis.
But I just know he – I always call it Denny Fisher. I've heard Denny English Fisher. People say it. I know that's a man's name, and he's the inventor of the Spirograph.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, the Spirograph. And this is something that, you know,
that's cool,
is interesting about the toy industry, is that we don't realize how global it is and how regional, yeah, it once was. So something, yeah, that was selling in the UK or something that was selling in Japan could be repurposed, repackaged, and shipped over here. And we didn't realize it had a significance. Like the Shogun Warriors, we didn't know these guys all had shows.
Well, there's that. There's when I found some Ultraman, you know, vinyl figures.
Oh yeah.
We should also point out that with the Shogun Warriors, how that was a huge thing for Mattel, that line of toys.
Oh,
they,
yeah,
also had.
But I still want to get on the Micronauts thing for a second. Sorry. Yeah, I didn't want to lose my train of thought on that.
No, go ahead.
I guess costs of, you know, like anything, it's a 12-inch doll with these different costumes. So they basically decided, well, how do we get costs down? How do we make this thing more cost effective? So they created the 3¾-inch action figure.
Oh.
And then because this is something Ray told me, their tooling costs, their R&D were through the roof for creating this Microman, which was huge. Mm-hmm. And Microman has its own backstory, its own history. I will post a ton of how effing cool Microman commercials are in Japan. Like, they are the coolest toy commercials you've ever seen.
Okay.
So then there was a company, and I can't remember the name of it, but the guy's name I think is Larry. He was pitching the line to toy companies here.
Okay.
And some of the Micronauts tooling already ended up in American toys. If you ever look at the Z Toys Metal Man line, which came out in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, I had some of those.
Some of those are Micronaut parts intermingled
in there. Those are really
– I love the Metal Man.
There's
I've got
a huge following for those things.
You know what? I have tons of them. I think they're fabulous. Yes.
Why don't you give me some?
Because they're heavy and they're expensive.
I'll pay for the shipping.
Oh, well, no.
But this is interesting because
So
what's happening that I'm starting to now associate at this time, as I'm 8 or 9 or whatever it is, to specifically associate with Japanese toys is missiles shooting out of every orifice or having, you know, missiles doing something, mm-hmm. and die-cast metal. Anytime I'd see the words die-cast metal, I thought it had to do with a Japanese toy. I'd never, besides like Tonka trucks, you know, I'd never, those are the only toys that I had that were die-cast. And so when the Shogun Warrior thing is so huge with Mattel, not only are they doing those giant, you know, 2-foot-tall figures, they're doing smaller versions that are die-cast.
Well, because all that stuff was around. All that tooling was available, and all they were doing was basically licensing it, right? Like, all these toys were developed for the Japanese market, and then you're going, well, hey, you know what? I'm going to try that over here.
Oh.
So, the same thing happened. The company was called CalR&D, by the way. The man's name was Larry Jones. Okay. He had a meeting with Mego. The people at Mego loved the Micronaut line, Microman line.
Right.
They went to Japan. I have a beautiful photo, if I can dig it out, that I got from somebody at Mego's archives of the Takara people and the Mego people all bonding in Japan.
Oh, cool.
And they took it over as Micronauts. That's cool. Now, and this is, you know, if you're a Mego collector, you've heard this story a million times, but if Mego hadn't gone bankrupt, they were probably the ones who would have got Transformers, because Transformers was spun out of Microman.
Okay.
So
I don't think I knew that.
So basically what we're talking about is Henshin Cyborg, something kids in the UK got, American kids never got, begat Microman, which then begat Transformers.
Oh, no kidding.
And, you know, the other thing that's interesting about that Henshin Cyborg thing is in the UK, most of the costumes were just generic for the characters, but one of them was it's just like a robot costume, but one of them was a Japanese TV character. And of course, because kids in UK would have never heard of the show, that it was just basically sold as like a robot.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of, at the same time, we've talked about this recently on an episode, Battle of the Planets is airing. Now, I don't know. I don't think I understood at the time that this was a Japanese show, but this would have been our introduction to Japanese animation, which led to, you know, Star Blazers,
yeah,
Space Cruiser Yamato, and all these, and then finding, you know, Japanese toys.
Now, I grew up in Toronto, so there was Toronto has and still has a huge Chinese community.
Okay.
And, you know, I think anybody with a Chinatown has seen some really cool toys.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
And, you know, I've heard people telling me some of the rarities that they've seen in Chinatown, and I've picked up some really neat stuff there. So, you know, we did get some imported shows or imported toys from there, and I kind of understood what was Japanese as a kid. I don't know why.
Well, I think I did, and my brain started to kind of, you know, get around it, but it was still – I knew the Shogun Warrior stuff. I didn't know that it was, you know, relaunched, you know, necessarily in the U.S., but I knew these were Japanese toys. But this is becoming, you know, all the rage. I mean, I don't – this is just a cool side note. I didn't discover this until I was much older, you know, as an adult collector, but I want to say Takara. I mean, these like Takara – Popey, you know, Grip, you know, some of these company names become very familiar when you're, you know, looking at these toys. Takara, you and I have one of the many things that we sort of obsess over or love when we talk about Star Wars is that Netherworld between, you know, May of 77 and May of 1980.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's just this. It's this insane world where the Star Wars universe hasn't been completely fleshed out or figured out. Same thing with you know, with merchandise, where you know Kenner in Canada was able to do those utility belts, just weird stuff. And Takara made this what is to this day still an amazing line of, you know, Japan specific toys.
Are these the die-cast figures?
These die-cast figures,
yeah.
Well, they die-cast X-Wing that transformed. They did another die-cast X-Wing. They did some various things. But the three figure, well, they did R2-D2 in many forms, but the ones that I had, I wish I'd never given them up. They did a Darth Vader, a C-3PO, and an R2-D2. The C-3PO had a missile that shot out. Again, yeah. The torso is die-cast. The limbs are, like, more plastic. Vader had a glow-in-the-dark lightsaber, and I think a missile. But the R2-D2 in that line is such a thing of beauty because it's everything that we're talking about, this you know, mental way of doing stuff. It's a die-cast R2. You had to apply decals for some of the details. Plastic, you know, the dome is plastic. Missiles, of course, shoot out the chest. The middle leg, you know, goes up into the body. But best of all, when you look, there's a little circular, you know, plastic clear bit that you look through the back of R2. And when you turn his head as it clicks, images from the movie are inside there like a Viewmaster. It's gorgeous. It's one of the best Star Wars toys ever made.
I've actually found a Darth Vader in a bin in a Toronto toy show once.
Really?
I couldn't believe it. It was like, this is crazy.
It's a crazy figure because it's got like a hole in the palm of his hand that you stick the lightsaber in, I think.
Yeah.
They're kind of crude, but they're kind of beautiful at the same
time. I love them. And you know, Popey actually took the Star Wars figures and they sold them in these little boxes. And then Popey was brilliant with this. If they brought in a line, like say they brought in the Mego superheroes, they would go, oh, well, okay, we're going to bring in Batman, Superman, and Spider-Man.
Right.
Who had his own crazy ass show in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
And then they would go, okay, well, why don't we also take this format and make our licenses? So they would make a Kamen Rider, an Ultraman, and, you know, whatever was popular at 5-man at the time. So, you know, which is like Power Rangers, which has gone on a lot longer than people here know about. And so they would make Mego format of these characters. So when Star Wars came out, they did the 3¾-inch, and then they took all their licenses again and made them 3¾-inch in the same packaging to make them almost look like they're of the same line.
Well, yeah, it's funny, but you just said that was Popey the one – then when they did – because we talked about Battle of the Planets. They did a Mark. Was that Popey?
Yes, they did a Mego Mark.
They did an 8-inch Amigo Mark.
I love those. I think the 90s, you know, I would send money to Hong Kong every month to get a new one of those characters.
You know, it's funny. I was such a – I don't know how I got away with this, but again, this was one of the things we talked about in one of our earlier episodes, I think, was the – you remember the toy shop, the trade paper?
Yeah.
I was able to get people to – I'd be like – I want this Japanese R2 diecast. Can you hold it for me? I'm going to send you $50 now, and in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I'll send you the rest. Is that okay? And people would do this for me, and I would. It was like a layaway system, so I could get these toys because they were pricey back then. I mean, try to find this stuff now, it's like forget it. But
then getting Japanese toys was insanely hard, unless you had a pen pal.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. But let's go back again. So we've got the Shogun Warriors. Oh, and by the way, just again another little side note, because I don't think we talked about this in the show. I wouldn't call this a white whale, but it's certainly something that I've kind of lusted after since I was a kid. And you can tell me the name of the company because I forgot the name of the company. But back at the same time, you know, 77, 78, 79 – utility belts are all the rage. Everybody from the Hulk to Star Trek to you name it. What was the company?
No, me. I had my own utility belt.
You had your own utility belt.
Yeah. It had a stapler.
Yeah, stapler.
Some gum.
They made a utility belt, which I think is one of the most brilliant toys ever made. A Shogun Warriors utility belt.
That was GLJ.
GLJ.
That's not actually a Japanese toy.
No, it's not. And that's one of the things I love about it. But it's not only is it not a Japanese toy, it's taken the Shogun Warriors thing, and it's insane because, you know, certainly the Hulk wouldn't have a utility belt, but
that would be a toaster cord.
Why a giant Shogun Warrior would bother with the utility belt. I don't know. But I found one, mint. I mean, the box is pristine, everything in it. And I recently picked that up, and it sort of ticked a box from many, many years ago.
I have the mod utility belt.
Which one?
I have the mod utility belt.
That's a hard one to find.
And if you press the middle button, it says, God will get you for that, Walter.
That's a tough one. You know, I had the Bob Newhart one, which
right.
was difficult. Yeah. The mod was, if you found a mod one, that was like one per case, I think, the mod. So there's that. So the Japanese toys are kind of crazy. Now, here's where it gets interesting, and I want to dedicate this episode
to me,
to you, to B. Arthur.
Good.
And I have two older brothers. One's called Gino, and one's called Jack. My oldest brother is called Jack. Jack, always been kind of a know-it-all. We've talked about him before, I think, where he was Star Trek. You know, he's like 10 years older than me, but he was Star Trek and I was Star Wars. So Star Wars came along. It was Han Solo versus...
That's a sitcom.
Captain Kirk. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So my mother works for Northwest Airlines. This is the mid-80s. And all her Northwest Airlines friends, again, mid-80s, all the rage, all the airline speak is, whatever you can get in Tokyo... you can get in Seoul, Korea, for a third of the cost. You know, because that's where it's all manufactured.
Right.
So these people would take these trips, and they go, oh, we saw it in Tokyo, and it was crazy, but we got to Seoul, and I got it for nothing. So this you know, she keeps saying this to us. We're gonna take this trip, and it's me and my mother and my brother Jack. We're gonna do Tokyo, and then we're gonna do Seoul, Korea, and then we're gonna come home. And you know, it's just kind of driven. I think the shopping district was called the Itaewon Mall, I think, in Seoul. And it's just, she's constantly saying, but just remember, you know, save your money, because there's a lot of stuff you can find in Korea. Well, all I give a shit about are Japanese toys. Like, I'm going to Tokyo, so I'm like 13, 14.
I hate
like that.
You.
And all I want, oh no, no, but you're gonna, it gets better. All I want. And on this trip, I don't care about anything else about, you know, I eventually, you know, loved the whole trip, and the culture I was exposed to was fantastic. But all I've got on the brain are the buckets of Japanese toys I'm going to come back with. And again, my brother's a bit of a know-it-all. So we get to Tokyo, and I mean, I bought a robot at the airport, I think the next shop we got to. But, and then my brother starts saying, hey, Jace. Just wait till we get to Korea. You're going to find all this crap in Seoul. Don't worry about it. Yeah, but what I should grab – no, no. You know what? Wait till we get to Seoul. Long story short, the next 4 days in Tokyo, he talks me out of every Japanese toy. I mean, if I could have gotten this stuff, I could have made literally $1 million tomorrow selling all this stuff. There was so much I passed up. We eventually get to Seoul, and I mean, I am – bursting. I am vibrating. I'm so anxious to get to Seoul because I'm going to buy all my Japanese robot toys. It was like tumbleweeds blowing through Seoul. It was as if the war ended the year before. Everything was being rebuilt. Tumbleweeds everywhere. I managed to track it. I found two robots in Seoul. One was a model kit, and the other one was all this great Japanese candy. Used to come with like a little toy or like a, you know, a robot kit. Uh-huh. So it was like a little box of, you know, malted milk balls. The other box that was connected to it was some kind of robot. So that was it. I got nothing. I came back with like four toys and that was it. And to this day, I hold it against my brother for talking me out of that.
Yeah, you've got a vendetta there.
Oh my.
He owes you a shopping trip at Mandaraki.
Can you imagine? I mean, just you go back in your brain and just imagine.
No, that would be.
Toys would have been on the shelf in.
Oh no, I can't imagine. And you know what? 83, 84.
Tyler, wait! Like, it's got to say that. This is just hitting me. I do not remember my dreams. I'm one of those people that if I literally don't write it down as I wake up, forget it. It's just hitting me now. I had a dream about you last night. I mean, you and I were.
Do you want me to turn the record off?
No, because it. Yeah. I'm lighting some incense right now.
Didn't involve massage.
It was you were in it, but you were on the cell phone. Like, you weren't with me. And there was some – I don't know if you were in another part of this toy show or what was going on. But these people, it was at some auditorium, and they brought all these amazing Japanese toys. And I got you on the phone asking about pricing. And one of them was some kind of crazy Japanese ship that came with, like, eight – I would say Mego-esque kind of characters that would go in this ship that I thought I could get for like $50. And the other thing, these are completely made up toys. This is all coming to me right now as we speak.
I love how Dream Toys seem so freaking real, though.
And I was so disappointing waking up because it wasn't real. The other thing was some kind of a toy weapon, and you know how much I love the toy weapons.
Your guns.
It was some kind of thing that like. You'd put it on your arm and like wings would pop out of it and it lit up and all this shit. And I got you on the phone and you're like, let me check into this pricing. And then, and this is where it gets weird because this is what woke me up. I put the phone down and then I couldn't find the phone. So you're calling me back, trying to give me the pricing on these Japanese toys. And I cannot find the phone. And when I woke up, I literally was so vivid. I thought I'd lost my cell phone. That's just coming to me now. That is an exclusive Pod Stallion's exclusive story, just me remembering that dream.
That's bizarre.
It just came to me just now. Isn't that crazy?
I have the. I'm sure if you're a collector, you've all had the toy dream, and yeah, the made up toys are awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Stuff that should have gotten made.
Your Japan story makes me feel a little better. What really triggered me to go back into collecting Japanese stuff is A, I've really got no goals right now. And B,
just life goals?
No, I got lots of life goals. Don't worry about that. I mean toy goals. I was very fixated on monsters for a while.
Yes.
And about, I think in October of 2012, I got everything I ever needed or wanted.
It's funny. You and I seem to go in these phases of getting sort of mildly obsessed.
Yeah, focused. Yeah.
Like, you know how they say when women work together long enough, their cycles sync up.
Okay.
It's like you and I are on the same cycle sometimes.
Toy loops?
Well,
toy
it's like, I'll give you an example, people. I recently discovered a Japanese toy on eBay. It was a ship from a film, right, called Message from Space,
which is a film we have discussed.
Yes.
It's the one where Vic Morrow has a robo love affair.
It's one of Vic Morrow's best science fiction performances.
It's the classiest film ever made.
The die-cast Message from Space ship with a little figure that – see, Bowie remembers it – with a little figure that comes in the ship. I found this listing, and it's pricey, but I'm like, isn't this cool? And I texted you and said, look – and at the same time that I found this die-cast ship, the large version, I came across this little gashapon version that's a little plastic miniature version of the diecast, and I already ordered it. It was like $5. I text you and say, I sent you the link, and I said, look at this super cool diecast Message from Spaceship. Didn't know it existed. Isn't it awesome? Your text back was literally, oh, that's cool. I have a little miniature version of that very ship on my desk.
Yeah, well, about a year
–
about
just ordered it.
About 6 months or 3-4 months ago, a friend of mine lent me the Popey 1979 or 80 catalog to scan and put on Plaid Stallions. And one of the toys in there, and this is going to Mystery Science Theater, have you ever seen the Fugitive Alien series? They're brilliant. It's a television series that was in Japan. I don't want to get into it too much, but I can't remember the original name of it. But Sandy Frank took and made two nearly incomprehensible TV movies out of it, and Mystery Science Theater got a hold of it. It's actually
Love
probably
Sandy a. I think if I ever had a kid, I'd probably call him Sandy Frank or Bananas Foster, one of the two.
I think I'd go with Sandy Frank. and the what I was trying to get at is I'm digging through this catalog, and they've got to ship the Bacchus 3 in those movies, and Popey had made a die-cast version of it. And I was like, oh, my God, I don't care how much that costs. I have to own it. And then, you know, that's not true. But then I checked on eBay, and this guy had one, and it was like $30 on the card. I guess it wasn't a popular toy.
Oh, wow.
And on the way out, he had some message from space, $5 ships, and it was like, well, got to have those, you know, and
I mean, this diecast, it is from Message from Space, right?
Yeah. Well, they re-released them, and they're they also made like a little Hot Wheels race car of Spider-Man's car. And speaking of
oh yeah,
diecast.
Well, did you ever have any of those? Any of the Spider-Man, the Japanese TV series? For those of you who don't know, Japanese TV series Spider-Man live action. Where he had didn't he have a giant robot too? That like
he had Leopoldin, which I'm pretty sure I'm saying that wrong. His giant robot, which actually I think was released in the Shogun Warriors line.
Okay, because
just as a 3¾-inch figure.
Back to the whole, you know, Toy Fair of the trade paper thing. As I'm collecting James Bond stuff, this is early '90s. We're talking. I had some UK contacts. I had plenty of US ones. I had a guy in Italy, and then I had a fella in Germany that. He's responsible for my vinyl cape Jawa. He got me a loose vinyl cape Jawa. He would find me this amazing James Bond stuff and some Indiana Jones stuff. He had a big Indiana Jones collection. He got me the is it like 8-inch, the 8-inch Spider-Man?
Yeah, I think it's like a modified Big Jim body.
Yeah, and he's got that stiff right arm,
but shoots stuff out
the wrist. I had that figure.
It had the coolest packaging on the planet.
Yeah, crazy with like
an overlay.
Yeah, that overlay. That's right.
Yeah.
But I had that.
I had it too. I got rid of it for space concerns, but I actually kind of like it. And they did a smaller figure of Spider-Man and the vehicles. They did the robots. I have a friend who's obsessed with that line because he saw that show as a kid when he visited Hong Kong one summer, and then when he came home, nobody believed him. And you know, he kind of digs that stuff. I had a tape of that in high school. That Japanese Spider-Man show. I was a popular nerd because
I bet you were.
I could send that to toy dealers and such because they'd never seen anything like it. I loved it.
Well, I didn't know
but that. It is a crazy show.
When I came across that toy, I didn't know before that. I didn't know that this show had existed.
That's a whole thing that really my love of Japanese television is based on is. That show shows Spider-Man fighting people, whereas you never saw Nicholas Hammond really doing too much when he was dressed as Spidey. And they, you know, I love a show called Kamen Rider. And Kamen Rider is a bit like a Sid and Marty Krofft show, except they're able to kick each other, right?
Kamen Rider, again, this is a live action.
It's a live action show about a cyborg.
It's been redone a dozen times.
Well, yeah, that's the beauty of Japan is, you know, 1 year, and I hope I'm not oversimplifying it for people who understand this already, but, you know, it'd be like having a show like Batman, and Batman is Bruce Wayne for season one, and the big villain is the Joker or whatever.
Right.
And then season two comes on, and, you know, he defeats the Joker at the end of the season. And then season two comes on, and it's a new guy, and he's taking on Batman, but now he's Batman X, and instead of Joker, it's a new villain. Or maybe it's an offshoot of Joker.
Right.
And then, you know, what you do is you get him fighting for the whole season. And maybe at the end of the season, Batman makes an appearance to team up with him. And then you repeat. So then you know, by the end of the 80s, you know, in Kamen Rider Black RX, which I was going to Chinatown a lot in my late teens and early 20s. And
Sounds like it.
And I was watching a lot of television shows without subtitles and boring my friends. but I would, you know, you would get these things where, you know, in the last four episodes of Black RX, he would be fighting alongside, you know, 12 different Kamen Riders.
Okay.
And, you know, it just became this thing. And I'm, you know, Kamen Rider, even when you watch them from the early 70s, they're kind of dumb. I will admit that. And with the subtitling is, it may even adds to the bizarreness of the whole thing. But at the same point, you can't imagine watching a show like this as a kid. You know, right. People are getting decapitated. The first episode of Kamen Rider V3, he watches his whole family get stabbed in the chest and die by a character called Scissors Jaguar, who looks like a jaguar with scissor hands, and its only bit of dialogue keeps saying scissor. So it's like it's a kid's show, but it's also really dark.
Was it called Scissors Jaguar? You said?
Scissors Jaguar.
That's another great name for a kid.
Or a band.
But it's funny you say this because just recently, I don't know how, you know, you do these, you and I, I'm sure as a lot of people that buy stuff or collect stuff, we do these crazy searches on eBay. And to me, eBay becomes like, you know how sometimes you look something up on IMDb and the next thing you know, you've been on there for 2 hours because it's like, oh, I didn't know he was in that. And that led to this movie and that guy did this or whatever. Same thing with eBay. And suddenly you don't know how you got to whatever.
I didn't know they made this. I need to own it.
Yes. And I have found a new there's a whole new batch of Kamen Rider toys.
Yeah, so now I find the new show too much like a toy commercial now. Like, it's too ridiculous. It always was a toy commercial.
Well, that's another thing, though. We should also talk about, like, I mean, wouldn't you say that, I mean, we can say, like, GoBots or Transformers or whatever, but didn't Japanese toy, but didn't they pretty much invent the transforming toy?
Well, yeah, they did. Yeah,
I mean, whatever it was, but so everything, every you know role play, you know, ray gun transforms into a sword. You know, every car transforms into a robot. You know, everything that whatever.
They definitely were the innovators in that sort of stuff.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and they're still doing it. You know,
well, yeah, you know what? I think I tried to watch new Kamen Rider episodes, like, you know, recently. And they're just a little bit like, quick, use your game card to activate your ray gun. You know, and it's like, oh, man. Like,
and go buy it at this store.
Yeah, it felt a little too forced. And, you know, my favorite thing about Kamen Rider was it was a guy, you know, jumping around. And these guys are wearing such bulky outfits they can barely move now, you know.
I'm looking at Plaid Stallions right now. And I think I found – this is from March of 2011. It's an ad. Looks like a color ad from. It says Space Robots UFO series, and it's got my.
That would be it. Yeah, I didn't know if I put that up or not.
It's Toy Fair booth. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Marukai.
Yep, that's them. Marukai. Now I want to bring up something now that you said that, because I also
who's
got
Space Commander. Who's that guy?
I don't have the ad in front of me.
Come on.
I know. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about was the I also fell in love with a Japanese toy line that just got imported here anonymously. It was called Shinsei UFO Commander, and it was given to me by my grandparents, and these were my mom's parents, and they had this weird thing where they would give me a thoughtless gift.
Okay.
But I would end up owning that for the rest of my life.
Okay.
You know, one year they gave me a Mego Spider-Man bank, and I was like, "Oh, thanks!" Like they always, it always felt like they just went and picked the toy up before they came to my party.
Okay.
I still own that. They gave me an Alex Raymond Flash Gordon book that
awesome.
Still had the discount price sticker on it.
Awesome.
And I think it's Flash Gordon Joins the Power Men. Still have it, heavily influenced me. They gave me a hardback book called The Trigun Empire, which I think is a British series of comics that is absolutely amazing, and I really appreciated owning it. And then they gave me a Shinsei UFO Commander vehicle called the Geek Tunnelin. Which had missiles, and it was supposed to drill into the ground. I played the hell out of this thing, and I still have it. And it's just one of those things where, you know, they're both gone now, but I have so much stuff from them. And it's weird because they didn't buy me a lot of things.
You know what's interesting, speaking of things being gone or how long, I'm looking at this, you know, this ad that you've got up on – Plaid Stallion.
So what did you say, March 2011?
It's March 9th, 2011. And someone makes a comment that's so interesting. This guy called, he's called Plastic Fetish.
Oh, yeah.
He says there's a lot of great things in that photo. A bunch of the diecast was by a company named ARK, and I owned and loved the Baltan toy when I was a kid. Marukai is a great market, and I was still buying imported Ultraman, Godzilla, etc. candy toys from them up until the time I left Southern California a few years ago. It's interesting. This guy had the Baltan as well. There's another dude here called Space Commander, which
he kind of looks like he might be one of the. Kind of looks like he might be one of the Space Kateers, but I can't tell from the photo. Maybe one of the listeners can answer that question.
Like a Tom Corbett Space Kateer. But we got to put the link up for this thing when this episode goes up, because just looking at this, if people don't know anything that we're talking about, when they see this photograph, they're going to go, oh, my God, I would have been obsessed with trying to get this stuff. Another thing that happens in the mid-'80s, I'm going to high school. My brother Jack, who I still vow revenge for the whole Tokyo thing, he's going to law school in New Jersey, to Rutgers Law School. And when we would go out, when I go out to visit him, I think I might have told this story on one of our episodes. We would go over the Ben Franklin Bridge into Philadelphia in an area called South Street, which I was just became obsessed with, because at that perfect age of like 15, 16, it had, punk shops, a clothing store, Zipperhead, Jim's Cheesesteaks, great record stores.
That's still a perfect Saturday for me.
Yeah, no, totally. But it also had, and this I think is the first time, I probably have told this story on one of our episodes, this is probably the first time that I'm discovering that there is a market for stuff that we grew up with, for people to, beyond a garage sale kind of thing. Oh, look, I found a Shogun Mori at a garage sale. Was a shop called Rocket Ships and Accessories on South
Street. Okay, you've told me about Rocket Ships and Accessories, and I've heard of them.
And it was even then you'd walk through the door and it was expensive, but they had, this is the secondary market. They had Migos, they had Kenner stuff. They had a lot of Star Trek, the motion picture, I remember, and they had a lot of Japanese die-cast toys.
I might actually have a picture of one of their stores somewhere.
I'll bet you do, because it was a very – and they were around for a long time.
Yeah, I think I've read an article where, they were being interviewed about sales of Star Wars figures in the late 70s. That sounds so familiar.
Yeah, I think you you know of what I speak. So when people will see this ad, they'll kind of know, they'll get it. They'll be like, oh my God, yeah, I would have tried to track those things down. Why I never, I probably will someday find the rest of these, but why I never, as a collector, went after the rest of those diecasts in that ARK series, I don't know. But that Baltan, maybe it's because I thought none of them are going to be as good as this Baltan. The one I wanted was King Joe. It was a crazy robot with the crazy antennas out the side of his head and stuff.
King Joe is an Ultra 7 villain. He's one of the classic ones.
And by the way, let's just remind people as we're doing these shows, if anybody wants to buy us any of the things we talk about.
Oh, please, yes.
In the episode, none of these things will be turned away.
I would love a Kamen Rider X Henshin Cyborg outfit. I can point you the eBay links, and you will get a generous thank you card.
Yes, and we'll mention you on a future show.
Yes.
So please.
This is almost like Kickstarter if you think about it. Look at that.
I don't want people to feel like they can't get us things just because.
No. And should we ever meet in public, I think I'm safe to say this, you can guarantee a hearty handshake.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Might even be a handshake, the double palm, like the clasping of the, it's so great to. Might even be one of those.
I guarantee two hand pumps.
Yeah, you're going to maybe get a couple of hand pumps. So, and don't take that the wrong way, please.
No, nothing, there's nothing smutty about those. Those are sincere. the other thing I wanted to bring up was a couple of things. One, I think Japanese stuff, my denial of it and my lack of having this stuff as a kid, really kind of was one of the many things that I can add to the tapestry that makes me a collector. I was bicycling by my friend's house, probably in the 8th or 9th grade, and he was having a yard sale.
Okay.
And he had his Mazinga Shogun Warrior. And I haven't seen this guy in 30 years.
Right.
But I was like, what do you want for that? And he's like, I don't know, a buck. And he thought it was weird. And I took his Mazinga home, and I'm staring at him. He's beat the crap. My daughter had made best friends with him, put him in strollers and stuff. But I still have the first yard sale vintage toy purchase I ever made. And this guy followed me through college. And
oh, nice.
And then I also started getting into Japanese model kits. You know that age, you know, you're not quite into girls, but you're not quite want to play. So I started, I never had any Godzilla toys. So I started ordering Godzilla and Ultraman model kits.
Oh,
and
cool.
And I had a real appreciation for Ultraman because there was a cartoon that was released on VHS at that time. And I got really, really into those that for about, you know, it probably was a year.
Okay.
But, you know, and then that kind of opened me up to toys and, you know, other, like it just kind of, it kind of expanded my, there's a market for this stuff. People yeah. like this stuff.
Isn't that interesting? Because yeah. the same time that we're talking about, you know, South Street, it's like I'm getting more into music and more into clothes and girls and all that stuff. But I still, you know, it's that dry season between, you know, when you put these things away in junior high until I sort of got to my early 20s and started, you know, collecting, where it was just bits and pieces. But model kits were like a gateway thing. Like, it was kind of okay to get into model kits. And there was a whole universe that I discovered of Japanese. I mean, I remember discovering, I had a couple of, again, these catalogs that we would get out of the back of Starlog and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Where there was a company that had all these amazing Captain Scarlet model kits.
Oh, yeah. I used to see those all the time with the figures. Yeah.
And you're like, what are these? Like, are these action figures or are these, you know, what the hell are these things? And so I started to get a lot of that stuff too at the same time. Do you remember Monogram? You'll know what I'm talking about. Monogram issued a black model kit, all black plastic, of a ship that was from a Gerry Anderson show, but they called it something else.
I don't think they did. I think that was a Gerry Anderson design.
Maybe it was MPC. Oh, I thought it was from Terrahawks or something. Was it a Gerry Anderson design?
Oh, well, there was one that Gerry Anderson called Star Cruiser 1.
That's the thing, I think, right?
Yeah, it wasn't actually a show. And, you know,
okay. I had that.
You bring that up, and that's the other thing going back to Japan. They love themselves some Gerry Anderson. And I think Gerry Anderson influenced a lot of their programs. You know, the way the guys in UFO go into their ships. And
totally. Have we done a Gerry Anderson episode? We did, didn't we?
Really? Yeah, of course we did.
We did.
Yeah.
Yes, we did.
Yes,
no,
we did.
No, they totally. I mean, there's a whole. We've talked about that Gerry Anderson collectibles book. You
have
that book, right?
I sure do. And I just picked up a. Like, what's that?
I'm sorry. Wouldn't you say like 75% of that book seems to be Japanese merchandise?
There's some really – they really love him. And
God. Oh my,
I just picked up something really cool at Mego Meat, which was a Gerry Anderson UFO book and record set.
Oh, cool.
And I am totally in love with this thing. And
didn't you get a super cool Japanese UFO pistol as well?
That's I don't think that's Japanese. It's made in Taiwan or something, but I don't think it's Japanese.
There's something that there's something about the aesthetics.
Yes.
The design of the Gerry Anderson shows. And I mean, I'm not saying it's specifically Gerry Anderson, but his team of people that is so fascinating to Japanese culture. I don't know what it is specifically.
I think I can actually boil it down.
Okay.
I think it has to do with the fact that they love vehicles, science fiction vehicles.
Yeah.
And so does Gerry Anderson. The idea that the characters all wore uniforms. Uniform culture in Japan is huge.
Yeah.
And I think.
And also, you know what? I'll go further. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but, and I always made this joke, you know, after the Tokyo trip, but it's like, I mean, that's a time that's pre-internet and pre, you know, all that stuff. But I mean, even then, you'd walk around and you'd see these, you know, young girls or whatever. Like the way people were, certain people were dressed, or the youth, it was like they were 6 to 8 months ahead of what was going to hit America.
Yeah.
There were at the time there were wristwatches that had water in them, you know, with like floaty things inside the digital wristwatch, just shit like that. Like they're just like, you know, 6 to 8 9 months ahead of the moon landing or whatever. And so you look at a lot of the Gerry Anderson stuff and the design. I mean, none of that stuff is dated. That stuff is so. You look at the Thunderbirds design. That could have been designed yesterday. You know, it could have been 50 years ago. It's just there's something timeless about that aesthetic, the uniforms, the ships, and everything. And a lot of the Japanese stuff is like that. I mean, some of the stuff. What's the, you know, Space Cruiser Yamato? I mean, that the concept of a battleship like that being a spaceship is still such an iconic, cool.
Oh yeah, I think that's next to Battle of the Planets toys. Not having Star Blazers action figures when I was a kid, I didn't get that channel, and my parents, as I've mentioned before, turned the television off every summer. But I would go to my friend Neil's house because his mom worked at the library, so he was a bit of a latchkey kid. Right. And I would watch every episode of Star Blazers, and we would end up doing marathons of, like, you know, I would watch Andy Griffith and Casper just waiting for Star Blazers every day. So I was a huge fan.
Yeah, it's. I think you hit it with the design, the ships, the sort of the uniform. You know, the aesthetic must have been, you know, very appealing. And to this day, I mean, I will go out of my way. There's so much great Japanese stuff being made today. There's a great. Now I'm going to get the name of the company completely wrong, but there's a whole range of like 6-inch figures that are being done with this. They're even doing them. Oh, I wish I had had this. They're even doing them for the Pixar characters. In other words, they're taking two-dimensional characters and they're making these amazing action figures. This company where you can change the eyeballs, or you can move the eyeballs. You know, from the back of the head, you can change the. They've done, you know, Indiana Jones. They've done the Christian Bale Batman. You know, the Marvel stuff. And again, the articulate. That's another thing that's interesting about the Japanese stuff. It's either like these vinyl toys that have 3 points of articulation, you know, the waist and the arms, or they're crazily, insanely articulated, in ways that people still haven't figured out. That's what I think of when I think of the Japanese stuff. So I'll still, you know, here and there, doing searches specifically. Coming across, you know, Japanese-made stuff, I'll go out of my way to grab it because it's just, you know, beautiful
stuff. They do good work.
And those minifigures, that's like a mild obsession now. Those little, because they're like $5 a piece. They'd have a little miniature Shogun Warriors. I've got a Kamen Rider. I've got the Message from Spaceship. There's other things, and they're kind of nostalgic packaging as well. They also did something really cool several years, and I forget the name of this company again. You might even know this. They did little vinyl Marvel figures in boxes.
In Mego boxes.
In Mego boxes.
Yeah, those were brilliant. I can't remember who did that, but I thought
those
were. I got
all of them. They did a Captain America, a Doctor Doom, a Thing, a Spider-Man, an Iron Man, and a Silver Surfer. I think that's all of them.
I forget who's doing it now, but somebody's doing vinyls in Mego boxes again, and they're doing like Swamp Thing and the Joker, but they're really expensive.
But those are larger, right?
Yeah, they are. They're much
okay,
bigger.
These are like 2-3 inches tall.
And they weren't expensive either.
No, and they were gorgeous. I think I've got the boxes too, but I've got all those little vinyl figures. So we could clearly talk about Japanese. We should do like a part two.
You know what? We should probably do our homework. Well, you know, with the Apocalypse episode, the minute I wrapped it, somebody wrote, "Hey, you guys going to talk about the Ultimate Warrior," which was a brilliant post-apocalyptic movie with Yul Brynner and Max von Sydow. I was so mad that we have forgotten that one, because I actually own it and I like that movie and I have a lot of goofy stuff to talk about in that. And it's like, we should just never close these.
Yeah, we should just keep. You should just keep recording. Like whenever, just have the button ready anytime I call, and just hit the record button. Because let's face it, all of our conversations are gold.
Yeah.
And it's hard to edit this shit. It's all like this. Every conversation, it's like Apocalypse Now redo.
And then if one of us dies from an overdose or something, you can host a nationally syndicated radio program, you know, like Ray Manzarek did, where, you know.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And then I'll take
the lost tapes.
Instead of, you know, financial, like, I'll just take toy donations.
Right.
To keep the show going.
Absolutely.
Again, can't stress it enough. Anything you want to send to us, please send via Brian's address.
That's right.
So I don't get in trouble. But we'll take, you know, any and all free toys you want to send to us. But yeah, we should do a part two. This is another one of those we should do a part two of.
Yeah. So please don't send us toys.
No, don't send us. We're just kidding. Don't take the no. Dude, no, but don't. Seriously, don't. No, it'd be okay if you did. But
no,
don't.
You know what? I feel bad.
You shouldn't. But if any, but you know,
I do okay.
It's okay. No, but don't. But thank you for listening, as always. Brian, you've let us down once again with your lack of information on everything.
Yes, I'm sorry about that. I'll try to work harder on that, sir.
I'll let it slide this time.
Okay.
And I hope everybody learned something, and you're all, you know, turning a little bit Japanese, in the words of the Vapors, after this episode. That was the Vapors, right? Wasn't it the Vapors?
It was the Vapors, and that's all I can remember.
Well, we all know what the song's really about. No, that's an urban myth. It's not about what you think it's about.
No, you know what? I was pausing because I don't know what it's supposed to be about.
Oh, maybe we shouldn't talk about it then. We'll keep it a mystery. Everyone's
well,
going to be...
it's totally a mystery for me until I Google it 5 minutes from now.
I'll text you off air.
Okay, see that you do. All
thanks,
right.
Everybody.
Thank you so much. Take care.